Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. Edited by Aaron B. O'Connell. Narrated by Patrick Lawler. Introduction. Moving Mountains, Cultural Friction in the Afghanistan War. Aaron B. O'Connell. There is a saying about the Prophet that most Americans know, even if they know little about Islam. If the mountain will not come to Mohammed, then Mohammed must go to the mountain. This old adage, typically used to suggest that some things can't be changed and that the wise person will bend to unmovable objects rather than repeatedly attempting the impossible, is a metaphor rich with relevance for America's latest, longest war. For years, it seems, the United States and its partners strove to change things in Afghanistan that are as permanent and insurmountable as the ancient peaks that have determined so much of the country's history and culture. Despite massive advantages in resources and technology, the effort to move mountains in Afghanistan has not worked, both because of the nature of Afghan society and because the United States has its own seemingly permanent and insurmountable cultural qualities that condition how the U.S. military operates abroad and for what purposes. This volume is a critical appraisal of America's combat operations in Afghanistan, known in military circles as Operation Enduring Freedom, which began in October 2001 and ended in stalemate on December 31, 2014. It is also a book about institutions and culture, one that explores the organizations that fight America's wars and the ideologies that empower and direct those institutions. The overarching thesis shared among the authors is that problems of culture were central to the war's outcomes. Specific choices by politicians and military leaders certainly shaped the course of the war. President Bush under-resourced the effort because of Iraq, and President Obama may have stayed too long or left too soon. But in the end, the most consistently important factor was the persistent cultural friction that pervaded interactions between Americans and Afghans and among coalition members. Despite three-quarters of $1 trillion and 13 years of trying, America and its allies could not convince Afghan rulers to adopt Western norms of governance, or rural Afghans to break fully with the Taliban insurgency. We argue that differing complexes of ideas about governments, states, democracy, freedom, religion, and the law were at the heart of that failure to persuade. These cultural obstacles became mountains in themselves that no president, general, or military force could dislodge or work around. This book is also about the United States' role in the world, specifically America's pattern of using military force to promote its values overseas. Afghanistan is not the first time the United States has pledged to install democracy abroad, or to protect foreign populations by winning their hearts and minds. Similar ideologies were at work in the Vietnam War, the Cold War, and earlier nation-building efforts in Haiti, Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic, and the Philippines. We argue that deep-running currents in American culture explain this pattern, currents that are unlikely to change direction anytime soon. We expect this argument will generate some controversy. Using culture to explain the war's outcomes will probably be greeted with skepticism by those military historians who like to focus on more quantifiable factors, raw numbers of troops, trucks, days of supply, and provinces and districts lost or gained. But tracking the quantifiable factors in the Afghanistan war sheds little light. For the United States and its allies had clear advantages over the Taliban in all those categories. By 2011, over 100,000 American troops were in the country, and allies added another 40,000. That same year, the United States spent over $100 billion on combat operations at a rate of roughly $11 million per hour. Against an enemy that was armed primarily with rifles and homemade bombs, the United States deployed the most advanced technology ever used in war: remotely piloted reconnaissance aircraft, biometric retina scanners, helicopter gunships, and advanced software that mapped IEDs, tracked tribal affiliations, and gathered intelligence at the speed of light. The troops were the best trained, the best educated, and the best supplied of any that have ever fought in Afghanistan. None of these factors led to success or explain failure. Something else mattered more. Experts in culture, anthropologists in the social sciences, and American studies scholars in the humanities in particular, will likely be skeptical of our argument, but for different reasons. Since the earliest days of their disciplines, those who study culture have struggled to reconcile their scholarly interests with the fact that governments want very much to use their expertise for military purposes. Some of anthropology's greatest luminaries have ended up on different sides of this debate. The father of American anthropology, Franz Boas, strongly opposed cooperation with the military. His students, Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict, both participated in War Department programs during World War II, and Mead even worked for the OSS, the predecessor of the CIA. A similar degree of collaboration with the U.S. government existed in the field of American studies in the 1950s. But following the upheavals of the Vietnam War, which brought several revelations of university involvement in secret military programs, scholars in both disciplines turned decidedly away from cooperating with the military. As a result, academics seeking to understand culture's effects in warfare are in something of a catch-22. If they have experience-based credibility in military affairs or work with those who do, they are often accused of militarizing academia. If they avoid the military, they lose access to the actual practitioners of warfare, who we believe have something useful to say on the topic. The war in Afghanistan reignited this debate, particularly in regard to the human terrain teams, a now discontinued DOD program that put anthropologists on the battlefield, ostensibly to increase cultural awareness in military decision-making. None of us had any involvement in that program, nor are any of us anthropologists. Instead, we hold advanced degrees in a range of other academic disciplines. Four of us are historians, two are political scientists, three are international relations scholars, and one has a background in the classics. We all served in Afghanistan in various roles: ambassador, rule of law advisor, infantry platoon commander, staff officer, Afghan police officer, and special assistant to the commander of the International Security Assistance Force. We are not bound together by a theoretical or methodological approach, or even common backgrounds. Two of us are Marines, three are Army officers, three are Naval officers, one is from the Air Force, one is an Afghan, and two are civilians. Some of us are Republicans, some are Democrats. Others are uninterested in political labels or unaffiliated with political parties. And while our various backgrounds lead us to different conclusions on a number of issues in this volume, we agree on two major points. The war has been less than fully successful, and an inability to turn lofty ideals into practical outcomes is a principal reason why. It is likely that some listeners outside academia will be uncomfortable with much of this book, too, for in these essays, military veterans and still serving officers question the conduct of the Afghanistan War and the assumptions that led to it and shaped its day-to-day prosecution. We ask, in a variety of ways, what good the billions spent did for the United States or for Afghanistan, and come up with strikingly little in the way of an answer. These are not easy topics for any American or Afghan to write about, particularly those who participated in the war. All of us are sensitive to the strong emotions both soldiers and civilians have on these issues, and we seek neither to provoke nor to offend. Our goal is simply to offer a fact-based accounting of the major events of the war and to generate debate about the assumptions and ideologies that led to those events. Culture wars and turf wars over culture. When Americans speak of Afghanistan, the word tribes usually appears early in the conversation. But American society has tribes too, as does the U.S. military. Indeed, in Afghanistan, the various Special Operations Forces, SOF, were even referred to as the SOF tribes, a term that highlighted their tight-knit nature and preoccupation with differentiating themselves from each other and from the conventional forces. Academics have their own scholarly tribes as well that draw boundaries based on method, subject, and pedigree. Even scholars of culture tend to come from two separate methodological communities, the social sciences and the humanities, which disagree perennially on how to study culture or even how to define it. These differences have hardened into turf wars inside the academy that flare up with regular and unhelpful skirmishes over terminology or ideology that are mostly irrelevant to all but the few in the fray. Much like actual land disputes in Afghanistan, no academic discipline has an uncontested claim to culture's intellectual turf. Anthropologists usually name themselves as the first owners of the field, but literary scholars contest that homesteading claim. In fact, both disciplines started studying the subject at approximately the same time, but came at it from different directions and ended up staking claims in adjacent and sometimes overlapping conceptual spaces. Since the 1960s, the cultural turn in academia brought a number of new trespassers in. Historians, political scientists, sociologists, economists, and international relations scholars, all of whom continue to debate approaches to culture to this day. Because of these battles over original appropriation, too many scholars of culture devote their energies to policing boundaries rather than crossing them, and to arguing among themselves rather than speaking to lay audiences. We take no sides on who should study culture, and we borrow from a variety of scholars and methods to make our arguments. All of us are admirers of the noted anthropologist and Afghan specialist Thomas Barfield, whose writings have done more than anything else to help senior policymakers and military officers understand Afghan culture. If we have an implied definition of culture, it is something of disciplinary hybrid. In the pages that follow, we borrow from the work of a sociologist, Emmanuel Wallerstein, a historian, Warren Sussman, and a scholar of literature, Michael Denning, to describe culture as the stories individuals and groups tell themselves and others to understand themselves and the world around them. Like other related terms, worldview, ideology, habitus, culture is a way to talk about the beliefs that have power in people's lives, whether they commit to them deliberately, borrow them from others, or repeat them uncritically simply because they have always been accepted in their communities as common sense. Oftentimes, it is this last category of ideas, the common sense beliefs that everyone already knows, that have the most power in a community, because their wide acceptance often serves as proof of their accuracy, a substitute for truth. Such unexamined certainties function like an operating system on a computer or a phone, invisible to everyday users, but constantly shaping the lenses, screens, and texts that serve as windows into the world. and when incompatible operating systems are forced to interact, the result is usually friction. Slower processing, a failure to connect, unanswered commands, and, in the worst cases, a crash. The terms cultural friction and cultural obstacles are important ones because they emphasize our central point that the problems in Afghanistan stem not from the cultures themselves, but from the interaction of incompatible cultures, both within the Western coalition and between the Afghans and the Westerners. Friction only occurs when two objects collide. A boulder only becomes an obstacle when someone tries to climb over or smash through it. We do not think either American or Afghan culture is inherently right, wrong, or universally true, any more than a boulder is right or wrong or true. We are not interested in evaluating either society according to prescriptive moral formulas. Our argument here is simple and specific. American and Western ideals, as expressed by soldiers and civilians in the Afghan War, proved inappropriate for persuading the Afghan people to change their behaviors and narratives. What worked in theory encountered difficulties in practice. As a result, the American-led effort to stabilize Afghanistan through counterinsurgency has already failed or is on a path to failure. Few of us have any hope that a course correction is likely or possible in the future. While the differences between Americans and Afghans were persistent and disruptive, they alone do not explain the outcomes of the war. There were also conflicts within the various departments, bureaus, and offices of the U.S. government and between the different elements of the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, or ISAF, the UN-authorized NATO command that ran the war and included military units from 50 different countries. This, too, is one of our volume's major themes. Because these organizations' cultures of bureaucracy so dramatically inhibited pragmatic policy and action, we spend as much time, perhaps more, exploring the friction between various Western institutions as we do charting the mismatches between the American and Afghan peoples and their governments. But if conflicting ideas were so central to America's failures in Afghanistan, why couldn't the various parties just change their narratives, adapt and overcome, as the Marines like to say? This question misses the fact that there is an intimate link between culture and community. People attach to beliefs not only because of their inherent accuracy, but also because holding them marks them as members of a group, whether Pashtun or Tajik, Marine or Green Beret, New Englander or Southerner, historian or anthropologist, Republican or Democrat. Thus, complex choices become even more so, as changing course places at risk the shared stories that give a community its cohesion, direction, and sense of purpose. This is particularly true with narratives that justify wars, and with books like this one that analyze and critique those narratives. Western Modernity, Cold War Culture, and the Modern American Military. A first rule of warfare is to know one's enemy, his strengths and weaknesses, assets and liabilities. A second might be to know thyself, to frankly assess one's biases and assumptions, and to evaluate their impact on both goals and tactics. In Afghanistan, the United States followed neither rule well. It did not understand the culture it was operating in, and it failed to appreciate how its own narratives and beliefs shaped action and generated friction. The result was a dramatic mismatch of means and ends that neither money nor technology nor the force of arms could overcome. American culture shaped every aspect of the United States' involvement in the war, the decision to begin it, strategic end states, campaign plans, and individual tactical engagements. No one was free from culture's reach. It affected the policymakers in Washington, the troops in the field, and the American people who followed the war with varying degrees of interest and awareness. It was America's belief in its own special providence, a tradition stretching back to the 17th century, that led President George W. Bush not only to pursue al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but also to insist that the country be remade into a democracy. It was the Cold War's culture of militarized foreign policy that made an unending and ubiquitous war on terror a seemingly reasonable response to the actions of several dozen people operating from Afghanistan and Germany and within the United States. And it was the modern American military's increasingly bureaucratic and technophilic style of warfighting that created regular friction with Afghans at the local and national levels. These three cultural habits brought the United States, its people, and its partners to an illogical and contradictory trio of conclusions: that a centrally run parliamentary democracy was a natural right for the Afghan people, that such a system was what they themselves wanted, and that even though it was natural and desired, it needed to be installed and defended with an occupying army of foreigners. Each of these habits deserves explanation. How did they operate inside American society, and how do they help explain success or failure in the Afghanistan war? The first habit concerns Western modernity and a specific American version of it known as American exceptionalism. Ever since Europeans first crossed the Atlantic, they and their American descendants have believed that their values are superior to all others and will, in time and with God's help, spread throughout the world to everyone's benefit. This prophetic, universalizing vision, which was Christian in its early iterations but developed secular analogs in the Enlightenment, has always contained a light side and a dark. The lofty rhetoric of civilization and liberation paired with military violence and race-based subjugation. The new institutions of the early modern era supported modernity's dialectic. Parliaments gave some citizens the ostensibly natural right of self-government and then denied the same right to women, slaves, and colonial subjects. Laboratories, factories, and universities produced both the evidence of reason's triumph and the tools for imposing it on others. Everywhere it spread, modernity brought with it the emblems of its contradictions. Ships that carried both scientists and slaves, colonial governments that enriched the center by impoverishing the periphery, and eventually technologies that could connect the world or destroy it. The result was four centuries of European conquest enabled by the benevolent rhetoric of freedom and progress. Americans like to believe that their country kicked this habit, that what makes the United States exceptional is its embrace of modernity without the corruption of colonial conquest. But that story does not square with the facts. New England Puritans spoke of an errand into the wilderness, a divine mission to establish a city on a hill, perfect the world, and civilize its inhabitants. And then they massacred the Pequot, Narragansett, and Wampanoag tribes for being uncivilized. The Founding Fathers railed against the injustice of colonialism, but then began their own century-long colonial project that reframed the conquest of the continent as civilization's blessing. Thomas Jefferson may have spoken of an empire for liberty and of governments deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. But he did so while advocating forced Indian removal and warning that, if ever we are constrained to lift the hatchet against any tribe, we will never lay it down till that tribe is exterminated. This pattern of pairing emancipatory narratives with military domination continued all through the 19th century in the Mexican War, numerous Indian Wars, and the Philippine-American War, which President McKinley later explained was done to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them. 20th century presidents, both Democrats and Republicans, eventually distanced themselves from full-throated endorsements of manifest destiny and the white man's burden, but only after their predecessors seized a colony and over a dozen islands and territories in the Caribbean and the Pacific. Even after rejecting outright conquest, American presidents still retained the related assumption that the United States should use its military power to advance Enlightenment values overseas. Woodrow Wilson sent the Marines to occupy Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua in order to teach the South American republics to elect good men, and fought World War I to make the world safe for democracy. Franklin D. Roosevelt justified World War II with similarly lofty rhetoric, and the eventual rehabilitations of Germany and Japan seemed to confirm that democracy could flower from seeds planted through military occupation. The Vietnam War caused a temporary loss of confidence, both in armed nation-building and in American exceptionalism more generally. But with Ronald Reagan's presidency, America returned to a providential vision of itself as a shining city upon a hill, with a rendezvous with destiny to be the last best hope of man on earth. The Cold War only strengthened Americans' stories of their nation as democracy's guardian, giving its people and leaders a misplaced faith in the universality of American values. As President George H.W. Bush explained in 1989, "We know what works. Freedom works. We know what's right. Freedom is right. We know how to secure a more just and prosperous life for man on earth, through free markets, free speech, free elections, and the exercise of free will unhampered by the state." For the first time in this century, for the first time in perhaps all history, man does not have to invent a system by which to live. We don't have to talk late into the night about which form of government is better. The collapse of the Soviet Union provided the final proof. Scholars began speaking of the end of history, a global consensus on the universal desirability of the West's political and economic systems. Every American war fought since has been framed in one way or another as a defense of these Western values, values that shouldn't need defending if they were actually universal. The war in Afghanistan was both a continuation of and departure from this historical pattern of remaking the world in America's image. The United States did not go to Afghanistan to colonize as it did in the American West, though that is an argument the Taliban have successfully promulgated among many distrustful Pashtuns. The original mission was to destroy Al-Qaeda and remove the Taliban from power. But that mission expanded into nation-building almost immediately, precisely because of the pull of these expansionist values. With George W. Bush's Freedom Doctrine, parliamentary political systems and free market economics became the non-negotiable demand of human dignity, the birthright of every person in every civilization. Elections became the proof of progress, even when they facilitated the rise of corrupt power brokers who undermined the legitimacy of the state. Experts spoke of teaching the Afghans democracy, as if they had no tradition of egalitarian, consultative decision-making. So grounded in the faith that their objectives were benign and desired, American politicians, generals, and ordinary soldiers did far more talking than listening, and tried to impose ruling systems on a people who have rejected foreign rule since the creation of the Afghan state. If the narratives of American exceptionalism helped frame the mission in Afghanistan, a second habit of American culture, the militarization of foreign policy brought on by the Cold War, determined the tools and techniques for accomplishing it. This habit also has a long history. While the United States has never been reticent about using force to protect its interests, it only recently developed a truly global military...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?